Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. My name is Podcast Mike. I work on the podcast with Will. Hey, at the moment we are doing our compilation series, Willosophies, and we are delving into the archives of the Willosophy podcast over the past few years and putting together some themed, curated episodes for you guys to listen to. If you like any of these, always feel free to head to tofop.com, T-O-F-O-P.com, to hear any of the chats in full and access the entire backlog of episodes. Today's theme is human rights. We've had some very, very, very great chats on this podcast with guests who are really passionate about this subject and offer some really, really insightful thoughts and opinions on human rights and refugee rights and that kind of thing. You'll hear today from Julian Burnside. He's a barrister and human rights activist, Jared McKenna. But first up, going all the way back to 2015, it's Corinne Grant, who's a comedian and also a lawyer. And she speaks a bit here about her thoughts on our treatment of refugees in Australia. Will's doing some live shows in December from December 7th to December 15th at the Comedy Store in Sydney. They're work in progress shows and you can get tickets or find some more information at willanderson.com. Hey, just a disclaimer that this episode does contain some themes that might be sensitive and might be disturbing to some people listening. So make sure if you or a friend or anyone you know needs help, reach out to Lifeline 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Hey guys, enjoy this chat with Will Anderson and Corinne Grant.
And what you're used to.
Yeah.
And it's why people fear outsiders, because outsiders do things differently. And yeah. What if you found out if they were worse, but what if you found out if they were better?
That's either more challenging. Way,
it challenges you, yeah. You know? I mean, you look at it with like things like immigration. You know, people are scared because these others are going to come in and they're going to want their ways in our country.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you're like, what would Australia be? Like, I haven't eaten an Australian meal this festival.
No.
You know, like, I mean, what would this country look like if, you know, the Vietnamese or the Chinese or the Italians or the Greeks had not come to this country?
See, that's a really interesting discussion that we should be having too, because the argument is always they're going to come into our country and change our way of life.
Yeah.
But then you say, all right, well, what is your way of life? Identify your way of life. And the best answer that most people come up with is, oh, fair go.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but what does that actually mean? If it was a fair go, wouldn't these people have a chance to come in here and have their way
have a fair go?
Have a fair go.
I mean, exactly. So where I'm staying here in the city, we're about a block and a half away from Spring Street, where the Victorian Parliament House is. So during this festival, a former Prime Minister of Australia, I'll explain for our overseas listeners, his name was Malcolm Fraser. Mm. And he was an interesting person because he was the leader of the Conservative Party in Australia, which is called the Liberal Party, confusingly, but we can't get bogged down in the nonsense. The Labor Party is also called the Labor Party, but rarely represents the workers rather than big business these days. But the Greens are probably still green. The Clive Palmer United Party is not particularly united. No. Many of these names are misleading,
yes.
So let's not get bogged down. But he was the leader of a Conservative Party. But during that time, he also had a particularly Vietnamese refugees. There was a time where a lot of them came into Australia and resettled here. And he was a person who, very interestingly, well, depending on which way you look at this argument, some people argue that he didn't change. The Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, got more conservative.
Yeah,
and
that's
he became left-wing. Or some people will argue that as he got older, his views probably softened and he became a little bit more left-wing.
Mm.
Either way, his original party didn't want to have much to do with him and he became more of a lefty champion than a...
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so a very interesting guy. But there was I was walking down the street to my show, and like the day after he died, or 2 days after he died, there was this massive, like what I thought was a protest rally, but it wasn't. It was a candlelight vigil of all these Vietnamese refugees who had marched down the street and then were making speeches, like about this guy. And I'm like, he was Prime Minister of our country. Mm. Now, whether you voted for him or not, none of us stopped and did fuck all.
No, I
like,
know.
I didn't have a candlelight vigil for him. I mean, I read the papers and I tried to, you know, acknowledge that, you know, he contributed to our country and all those sort of things. But I did fuck all. These people who came here on fucking boats to fuck up our country were fucking it up by being respectful of this guy. Like, I mean, you know.
That's it. Like, he resettled 90,000 Vietnamese in Australia. And I don't think it changed our way of life, apart from that we now get awesome Vietnamese food.
I mean, the Vietnamese community is a wonderful part of the
Australian community. Yeah, exactly. And has added to our culture. It hasn't changed our way of life.
No, we get to have all what we had
plus
that. Okay, well, that's interesting to me. It's interesting that, you know, refugees have come up again. That's that idea of looking after someone. Because, again, okay, why refugees? Of all the people who are vulnerable, and it's a question I get asked sometimes as well when I am supportive of like that or talk about it. You know, even in my show, when I was doing my political show at the festival, I probably had about 10 minutes of that talking about, you know, our approach to refugees. And you know, I could even feel it in the room. There's some people just going, why do you care so much about this? Yeah. And I'm not even sure I know why. Why do you think you care so much?
I care about it because, and also I think it's important too to say that just because I care about refugees does not mean that I do not care about anything else.
No, like, it does.
There is no...
It means you don't care about homeless people in Australia.
This is where, these are the arguments that get thrown at you, that all of a sudden, you know, you can only care for one thing at once, which I think shows a great lack of imagination if that is all you're capable of doing. But for me, the asylum seeker refugee debate and the way that we treat those people is the worst thing that we are doing. They are the most vulnerable people in the world. They have nowhere else to go. Their country has kicked them out or they've left in fear of their lives and they have nothing and they desperately need help. And those are the people that we've chosen to attack. Like, they are completely defenseless and helpless and begging for our help, and yet we're kicking them. That to me says an awful lot about our country, and none of what it says is good. And
Corinne,
you can't fix that, you can't fix anything else.
I read in the paper today that Australia is the most expensive place to live in the world because we're doing so well. So we can't afford to have these people coming here.
Yeah, see,
this small amount of vulnerable people
back
in
to
the
my
richest
philosophy of do more for others than you would for yourself. After you've taken care of your basic needs, right? I'm not saying, you know, be some kind of martyr who doesn't sleep and gives up all of your clothes and your food and everything. Like, look after yourself first.
Right, but it is one of those things where you're absolutely right. They always attack that one. Like, you know, the argument they will go to is like, oh, well, there's homeless people here who could do with that money. Yeah.
Yes.
Look, what we're saying is the money's all out of whack all over the place,
guys.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I'm just going to concentrate on this area right now. Yeah. And, you know.
But also, we would have more money to help homeless people in Australia if we weren't spending literally billions of dollars to keep these people on offshore detention facilities.
$500,000 a year per person, they
yes.
say.
Yes, it's billions.
To keep them there.
Yeah.
Like, to keep them in this place that the UN has accused us of torturing people, that the Human Rights Commission have accused us of torturing people, that Save the Children have accused us of torturing people. But we all know those fucking organisations. I mean, come on, mate, this is Australia. We're not in favour of Uniting Nations giving Saving Children.
You know what, that is such a bullshit argument too. I'm not going to be dictated to by the United Nations. Yeah. Well, you were the one who signed the treaty, dickhead.
We're on panels.
Yeah.
Like, we are literally on, like, we're running shit at the United Nations. We don't play by these rules.
It's like,
you started fucking Fight Club, and now you're telling everyone about Fight Club.
It's like going down to Maya and putting a TV on lay-by, and then Maya sends you a bill saying your next $50 is due, and you're just saying, I'm not going to be dictated to by Maya. Well, you're the one who said, I'm going to sign up for this. So we're on all of these, like, for 50 or 60 years, we've been on all of these treaties and conventions saying we won't be assholes to vulnerable people.
Right.
And now we're going, but we want to be because it wins us votes. And that's essentially what it is. We're wasting billions of dollars.
This is the same country that was at the forefront of the boycotts against South Africa.
Yeah.
People who might not remember this.
We still lecture Syria and Egypt in their human rights abuses and China while we're doing worse things here.
Right. It's insane.
Yes.
Like, you know, the countries that are being lectured to by the UN for torturing people are those countries.
Yeah.
They're South Africa and the ideas. And now us.
Yes.
To the point where our Prime Minister is sick of being lectured.
Yeah.
That's how much we're being lectured. Yeah. That he's sick of being lectured.
Well,
now, most of us see an obvious solution to that. Stop torturing children.
Yeah.
But he's like, no, just stop lecturing me.
Yeah. Let's just keep doing it because I might win some votes out of it. You know what? I genuinely don't think most Australians know what's going on and don't care, and I don't think that it sways their vote.
Well, I think I think what they've realised really well, and they're smart about it, and I think they're right, is that Australians, like in a general sense, stop the boats. Not our problem anymore, right?
Yeah.
If you stop the boats and we're not hearing about it, because the truth is the boats haven't stopped. Let's be completely
honest
about that.
They're just being turned around.
They're turning around the boats. This idea that they're so concerned about, like, and this is the new thing, and it's been very clever. They've reframed the argument a little. No, we're saving lives. It's about deaths at sea. Well, if you're honestly serious about that, you wouldn't be turning around rickety boats in the middle of the ocean. But secondly, we just bought 10 Vietnamese fishing boats to take people back. We're still having to expand these detention centres.
Yeah.
So where are those people coming from?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think we've stopped the boats.
And this is like, even if you...
But we've stopped hearing them. That's what people wanted.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. Because, you know, these people are going to come to our country and steal our houses and eat our babies, apparently.
This is an interesting point. It costs us so much money.
Yeah.
$500,000 a year to torture these children. $500,000 a year for these people to be...
Per person we're talking
per
about.
Per person.
Yeah, yeah. So it's billions upon billions of dollars.
Like, I mean, I don't know how much it costs to come here and be part of the community and help us build our country.
An awful lot. Like Julian Burnside, who's a human rights lawyer, has done some maths on that, and it costs something like $3,000 a week to house a refugee in the community. I could be making that statistic up, but it is phenomenally less money. And you give them work rights, and then they work, and then they pay taxes as well. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody. You just end up with a few more brown people in your community.
Right.
And really, you know, we should be able to cope with that.
Yeah, that is probably the major issue, though, at the end
of
the day. Let's
be
honest.
Is.
It's a very interesting moment in our history, and I can't help but thinking that we're making decisions at the moment that we are going to have public apologies for in the future.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, this feels to me like, you know, when you look at something like the apologies of the Stolen Generation, you look at you go, how could we be these people? And then you look at what we're doing now and you're like, oh, fuck, we're doing it again.
Yeah, we really are doing it again. Well, people here are frothing at the mouth going, we can't afford them. We're battlers. We're struggling. No, just because you want a 64-inch television and you can't afford it does not mean you're struggling.
Well, the other thing is also, though, but the politicians and the mainstream media have done a very good job of convincing people that the reason they don't have what they want is because the person one below them on the rung rather than the people 50 above them on the rung.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's interesting to me that a man who gets a $900 million tax rebate from the Australian government for basically some accounting and spends $30 million a year loss on the Australian newspaper every year to pollute the Australian population with his lies.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I always like to explain to people about the Australian is loses $30 million a year, the Australian, right? So, and has the most like right-wing conservative, you know, clearly, you know, wanting to be influential views. If someone came now to Australia and said, hey, I'm new in the country, like a Clive Palmer type, you know, comes into Australia and is like, here's my idea. I'm just going to set up a newspaper. It's going to lose $30 million a year. I just want to get my opinions that I have directly to the politicians and influence their policies so that I can get large financial dividends like a $900 million rebate for doing nothing other than some paperwork. We would be like, no crazy billionaire from Superman. Like, you can't do that, right? It's a crazy idea that in a democracy we let one voice, one power.
Yeah.
Like, and can't argue that it's operating as a business, literally doing it to influence government.
No one freaking reads The Australian either.
No.
Apart from other people in the media who then report on what was said in The Australian. If they stopped reporting on it, no one would know what was written in The Australian. Because a lot of it's like the worst of the Tea Party. Like, you read those columns, they don't even logically make sense.
Oh,
they start
it's the best.
At one point, no, and then it's like a stream of consciousness of just craziness.
I honestly believe there's a cut and paste feature
at
The Australian where they just like, oh, I'm three paragraphs short. Lefty, lefty, lefty conspiracy, ABC, climate change, lefty conspiracy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I shouldn't even probably, you know, talk about it so much. But I think that what those newspapers and all those things have do a lot is say, please don't look at us up here ripping you offline, being the reason that not everybody can afford everything. Look at the people who are below you and even more vulnerable and blame them.
And that's what that was the point I was going to make about the asylum seeker thing when I lost my train of thought was, even if you do think that these people deserve to be locked up over, you know, on islands off the coast. Let's just say for a second that they do deserve to be punished, that they deserve to be locked up, all those kind of
things. Why can't they stay in places like Iraq and Syria?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Just say you believe all of that. At the same time, are you really comfortable with your government lying to you about how much it's spending and lying to you about the success of the campaign? Like, surely, you know, Australians don't like being bullshitted to, and you've got a government that is like the worst bullshitters of all time. That should shit you.
I mean, when the Human Rights Commission report came out and all they did was attack the person who put out the report rather than at any time addressing anything
it
that was in
so
the
childish.
Fucking...
It looks so childish. It looks so childish.
Like, it's biased. You mean this report that is equally mad at both you and the previous government? Yeah, it's biased in favour of the children, I guess.
Well, they didn't know who it was biased in favour of because they didn't read it.
Yeah.
Ian McDonald, who was heading the inquiry into Gillian Triggs, hadn't read it and said he wasn't going to because he'd heard it was biased. He got paid $22,000 to front that committee.
Right.
And he didn't read the freaking report.
Yeah, that's money we could have spent locking
people up. I would have
got
sacked if I did that. Imagine, you know, you had a job and you came in and said, have you analysed that report? Nah,
no.
Heard it was biased. We're not going to pay you for that. Oh, what do you mean you're not going to pay
me? What do you
mean?
No.
I'm awesome.
Yeah.
Is that your answer? Yeah, that's my answer. I'm awesome.
All right. We can't bang on about this all day. So, but, you know, that was nice. It was good to talk about that. I think it's important.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me, we're jumping around all over the place, but that's fine. I like that. So what I really wanted to start with was you talked about being a comedian. You talked about being a writer. You talked about being an actor. But you also, at the end, said you're studying law. And that will probably be, for people who don't follow things closely, the most interesting one, because less people probably know that's the case, right?
Yeah.
But it's been going for ages now.
Oh my God, it feels like forever. Yeah. it's only been 3 years. I'm in my third year now. And that comes out of my strong belief in social justice and wanting to do more for my community and for the people around me as well. I just got to a point where I was emceeing rallies or facilitating panels, and all I could really do was comment on things. I couldn't actually stick my fingers into the world and change it myself.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I decided to do a law degree, so that I could start practically making a difference to things.
A couple of things. What's your aim with the law degree? What would you like to do when you have it? That's the first step.
Well, ultimately, work in that social justice area, which, you know, if it's you start getting boring and technical about that, but there's a number of different ways you could do that. So, you know, I've always been involved in the union movement. So employment law, for example, on the side of workers and helping them to make sure that they're getting all of their entitlements and that kind of thing. Human rights law, refugee law, which, as we all know, you make millions out of.
Millions.
So I'm going to do that because I'm going to be really rich.
Right.
Yeah, I want a yacht and I want to meet Bono.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to do. No, the human rights law is the kind of thing that you do on the side because you don't get paid for it nine times out of ten.
It's like going back to comedy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Except
one
that.
Good corporate gig and then all my arty shit on the side that doesn't pay for itself.
Except the chance, you know, you've got the slim chance that you might save someone's life. So that's really cool. And then just other social justice issues in amongst that, you know, women's violence, all of that kind of stuff.
Corinne Grant there with Will Anderson back in 2015 for Willosophy. Hey, it's Podcast Mike here. We're doing our compilation series, Willosophies, where we're putting together some of the best bits from over the last few years of the podcast. Tofop.com for the full versions of any of the chats you hear today and the entire backlog of the show. Over now to Jared McKenna. Jared is a prominent Christian leader. And about a year ago when this episode was recorded, Jared had just come back from Manus. This is a really, really interesting chat that highlights firsthand the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers in Australia.
I'm going to listen and I'm going to ask questions and maybe occasionally I may ask some naive questions. The thing that I am not going to do is present the case for the other side. I know that sometimes people in interviews enjoy the idea that I will prosecute the other arguments. When it comes to this topic, you can find those other arguments in the daily newspapers every day, written by professionals who are being paid a lot of money to make those arguments. Mm. They are widely available. They will not be presented by me here today. If that pisses you off, that is absolutely fine. Keep it to yourself. So, with all that said, Jared, tell me what you've been up to.
I just got back from Manus, which is an island just north of Papua New Guinea's mainland. It's very beautiful, and there's some really horrific things that our government are doing there.
So, let's start with that, because some people... maybe some of our international listeners aren't familiar with this story at all, although it has been getting some coverage in places like the New York Times, because it is an international shame and disgrace what is happening. So give the people some background on what is happening on Manus Island.
Yeah, it's weird, Will. So the day that they call it a processing centre, even though none of the refugees that are there have been processed for over 1,500 days. It's like over 4.5 years, but it's called a processing centre. And when it was destroyed by the military, was it yesterday, the day before, it was number one on Deutsche Welle's homepage. It was number one on the BBC's international news homepage. It was number 17 and dropped to 20 on the ABC's homepage after a story of a guy being attacked by a crocodile and making it away. So in terms of priorities...
And by the way, that happens in Australia like every third week. So really shouldn't be that big news.
That's right. So there's this strange thing why we aren't paying attention to it, but it's actually designed that way, like out of sight, out of mind. We don't want to know what's actually going on.
Okay, so that idea of putting our problems somewhere else, because here's the starting point. There are displaced people all over the world. You know, refugees is a massive issue worldwide. Yep. And the other thing is that Australia disproportionately... is actually quite low numbers. Like, I know we always talk about this idea and we hear in the media that somehow we're going to be flooded by these people, but compared to the rest of the world, the access to Australia is actually pretty minimal, and you have to be pretty desperate to go through the risks that it takes to get here. If you are caught by the Australian Navy, is that who does it normally?
Yeah.
Right? You get sent to one of these processing centres.
Yeah.
And there you are getting processed. So... firstly, let's go with the idea of outsourcing the problem.
Yeah.
What do you think the value of that is? Why is that such a powerful tool when it comes to keeping us from knowing what's going on? Oh, yeah, the dogs are angry about it as well.
I need
to point out that Ramona and Winona...
worked up.
Yeah, there is no balance in this studio. They both are very passionate about the issue as well.
They know their family histories and that they're from elsewhere and they feel passionate about it. Maybe we should start with what the problem is. The problem is that there's war and people persecute other people groups. And while there is still war and while there is still persecuted people groups, there's going to be people who need safety. And after the Holocaust, the Shoah, when 6 million Jews were... experienced genocide in Nazi Germany, the world said, never again. We're not going to allow boats to be turned back like they were from places like the US. And instead, they said, we're going to make it a legal framework for people to find safety around the world. And that's all refugee means, Will, is somebody like you and me, only they need safety. So the problem, if you want to frame it like that, is that these awful things happen to innocent people who need a safe place. And of course, we need a way to process them. And in the 1970s, Australia was one of the leaders in how we process. So Malcolm Fraser, under a Liberal government, we were a regional leader in a compassionate response to refugees. We've done that previously. There's no reason we can't be doing it now. But instead of leading our neighbours, who are much poorer than us in the region, in compassion, we're leading them in cruelty and pushing our problems off to this very small island, which is very poor, who are really struggling to uphold their traditional customs of hospitality for what is actually our responsibility. But if we actually pull that back and ask questions that maybe this is wrong, the whole thing that's set up, and we'll dispel out like what is being set up and what we saw. So for the last 24 days, all water, electricity, power, and medical support was cut off in this centre as a way of driving the men out of this processing centre.
So why had the men stayed? Because,
yeah,
again, like, some of these questions are going to seem simplistic, but I think it's
worth talking
about this.
Yeah.
Which is, I think people would have seen vaguely, if you pay any attention to this, that the idea that the actual camp was shut, that people had been released into the community. Mm. A, is that even a real thing? Or B, what did that mean? C, why did the men stay in that case?
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about that the new centres they set up weren't finished, and that's true, they're not finished. Others were talking about that a lot of the men who were in there had experienced violence, including by being beaten by the police. Some of the complexity of that story is that the police is actually staffed, if you will, not from local Manusians, but from mainland Papua New Guinea. I met with leaders who talked about a young man in their community who had been killed by local police, and they weren't getting any consequences or any way to pursue justice in terms of that. So those things are true, but the main reason is, and we'll get to this, but I ended up spending 25 hours in the centre because we were caught by the Navy, the Papua New Guinean Navy. And so they're not allowed into the centre at all, because on Good Friday, they played out this weird passion play where the military fired their weapons into the centre after getting drunk at the military base next door. So Australia took the weapons off the military people and said, you're not allowed in the actual base. And so we had to seek safety, seek refuge, ironically, in the refugee processing centre, which had been abandoned by everybody apart from these 423 the day that we were with them that were there. That centre, the reason why they didn't want to leave is because it's the first time that they've actually had any agency around their own future. So I was there for 25 hours and found it played games in terms of my mental health being there for that long. Imagine that over a week. I'm not sure. Imagine that over a month. Imagine that over coming up to 5 years. That's what these people have been through. Over 90% of them have been found to be genuine refugees. That means that, yes, they are fleeing war. Yes, their lives are at risk if they go home to their own country. I met a man who had been offered $25,000, his Rohingya, to go back to Myanmar, as in Burma, as in where there's a genocide happening at the moment. And this is the kind of craziness that Australian government offering people money to go back to a situation where they'll be killed, because people don't want people seeking safety, refugees, in Australia.
The financial aspect of this is probably something I don't want to get bogged down in, but is worth mentioning, is just one of the greatest outrages of it all. Because, you know, the way that it gets spun by, you know, those who oppose these points of view is like the idea that it's some sort of drain on our economy, when what we're actually doing at the moment, this hideous thing we're doing at the moment, is a drain on our economy, a stupid financial black hole of money that we are spending so much of, like, our money we work
with. It's about $4 billion a year.
Right. To do really inhumane things to people. Okay. So you sleep a little, and then what happens the next day?
We wake up and it's maybe 35 degrees and it feels like 100% humidity. And this is what they're living in all the time. My ankle is red and swollen and gross, and I couldn't believe it got infected in such a short amount of time. The guys find out we're awake and they bring us breakfast, which we're like, don't feed us. Yeah, that's how I felt as well.
Yeah.
This is your supplies. You need this. We'll be fine. 24 hours, we can fast. Like, and they're like, you're our friends. You came here with us. You are the first Australian detainees. You are a part of us. You will eat the food with us. So they made sure that no one in the camp went without any of the food.
We have solved the dog problem, at least temporarily, by placing Ramona on Jared's lap, and now she's getting her back scratched. So I think she just really wanted some attention. Winnie was laying on her pillow that she likes to lay on, and she does not share well, Ramona. Winnie will share with anyone, and Ramona is a little bit more of a princess. So the attention she's now getting will be, I think, beneficial to the podcast. I will check that we're re-recording. Yes, we are. We're back. Okay, so where were we up to? So it's the next day. You're in this, place where you don't... You're waiting until that night, right? You know that you can't get out, get off until that night. So what happens during the day?
Both... A number of the guys thought that people would be so excited that we were there with them that they'd decide that it's probably best to keep it quiet. One of the things that happened during the day is one of the guys was tweeting that I was in there.
Right.
Hashtag Manus.
Yeah.
And thank you, Pastor Jared, for being with us. Thank you, Australia, for sending him. Yeah. Hashtag Manus. And we're like,
Ixnay on that hashtag, hey.
Yeah, that's right. Because it would create danger for the guys that were in there.
Absolutely it would.
Yeah, and they're expecting that the Australian government would force them out, which we saw happen brutally yesterday. I'm still receiving pictures of guys who have been beaten, and you think about me slashing my ankle open. These guys have got lacerations and bruises and all the rest, and they're in that tropical setting at the moment. Like, it's just so full on. So we lay low, Will. We didn't do... much at all. Some of the guys came in just wanting to talk with us. Some of them wanted to talk about Martin Luther King. Some of them they had a copy in the room where we were staying of Nelson Mandela's The Long Road to Freedom, and how well read they are. And so we'd meet an engineer or an up and coming soccer star who had to flee Iran, or somebody who studied to be a teacher, or somebody who did business and law. Like, it's this huge resource of people with stuff to give, and they're spending their days trying to ration food because we've cut off all food, and they've got their futures are frozen. There's no... And so our days were these incredible meeting with phenomenal people who I have no idea when they'll see any sense of a sane life or freedom.
Okay, so nighttime comes and you have to repeat the process from the previous evening.
So we get a message from the people who were going to extract us, this kind of like Manus Black Ops, Manus Impossible kind of team. And they're like, we can't get a boat to shore. We're going to need you to swim, but we have an idea. And they had three deep sea divers who were going to swim over a cay from out in the ocean over the reef, bringing a barrel that has a seal on it to put Olivia's $12,000 worth of like camera equipment, which is her livelihood, in this barrel. And then we would need to swim with them. And they're like, it's okay. We have... Actually, maybe I shouldn't say what they were going to use, right, but a way to do a flash signal and all the rest. And that was the plan. And so we're freaking out a little bit. Like, I surf, so I'm like, okay, like it's pretty calm. This will be, but we're exhausted. And we're so appreciative for the Magic Noodles and tuna that they shared with us that were smuggled in. But we haven't... I probably got the most sleep. I probably got 4.5 hours sleep. Liv's had half an hour sleep. And we're supposed to swim over a kay into the ocean, over the reef, and then wait, treading water, to be picked up by a boat that was going to take us to safety. So we're kind of freaking out a little, but we're like, okay, this is what we have to do. We have to do it. The guys arrive in the camp who are going to take us out. They bring it, and Olivia's camera bag doesn't fit in it. So she's freaking out, and so unpacking the camera, wrapping it in plastic bags, putting it in there. The inside of the container is actually wet. She's freaking out that it's going to leak. We get the stuff in. We put our clothes in, which we're just soaked with sweat, and there's mud and everything from where we fell. And we hand back, once we get down to the beach, the clothes that they'd lent us. So... I mean, the gospel reading for this week is Jesus saying, whatever you did to the least of these, you did to me. So I was hungry. Yes, we were. And they fed us, even though we haven't fed them as the Australian people. I was naked. Well, we weren't naked, but like we were needing clothes and they clothed us. We were a stranger and they welcomed it. They pretty much just went through the gospel passage and went tick, 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 tick. Let us be Jesus to you, while Australia has shown them none of that kindness whatsoever. We get down to the water with this tub. The rest of our stuff is in a bag, and we get in the water after stripping down to bra and undies. Just to clarify, I'm not wearing the bra and undies. Olivia's wearing bra and undies. I'm just wearing undies. And we
funny bit in the movie, though, if you're both right. wearing bra and undies. That's just a little bit of comic levity in the middle of this like high-pressure drama situation.
It's purely a comfort thing. And then we start swimming. And I'm having a great time, Will. Like, it's beautiful. It's the tropics. It's warm. There's these, like, lights in the water. Every time you take a stroke, there's all these lights that come up. There's the stars. Olivia is not having a fun time at all. She put her foot down on the reef and she's got like some spikes in her foot. I don't think it was coral. I think it was like a... So she's like, is this a starfish or something? Am I going to stop breathing while I'm swimming out here? She's we both calling on the name of Jesus in different ways, but both just like freaking out, like
I think that's what I said to you when we were communicating on WhatsApp. I said, Jesus, in the way I mean it, and in the way you mean it.
That's right. we get out past the reef and they pull out their thing, which they're gonna signal with to the boat. And you know, even if English is your first language, there's it's confusing, waterproof and water resistant. So it's not working. And it's not working so they can get the right number of flashes.
Right.
So we're swum for 20 minutes. We're sitting out there in the water after being exhausted and all the rest. And we can't get... And one of the guys says, I have a backup plan. And he pulls out his lighter, his cigarette lighter. And we're like a K and a half off the coast, sitting in the dark. And he's trying to light his lighter that's been in his pocket while we've been swimming.
Okay, we don't need the bra and panties scene anymore, because I think the guy trying to start his lighter in the middle of the ocean will be the comic levity that we need for this part of it.
But here's the, like,
does it light?
Both ways of calling on, like, out Jesus.
Yeah.
It works. Like it actually works.
It's a miracle.
It's
a miracle, Jared.
People interpret it how they want to interpret it. Yeah. Sometimes miracles actually get through.
It's a miracle.
like, it actually works, and... out of the black of the night, this boat just starts drifting towards us quickly, and we have to get out of the way. And then, like, they pull us up, they pull the camera equipment up, they start up the engine, and we just belt it out to sea. Oh, I mean, it was like the most surreal.
How are you feeling? Like, in moments like that, when you are, you know, a person who believes what you believe, is there a peace that comes from that, or are you just as, like, insanely, you know, humanly fucked up and high pressure as everybody else would be in that situation?
Maybe more so. Right. Like, maybe that's why I need Jesus so much. Is like, I'm like, what? But I was also delirious. Like, so at some stage swimming out, because it actually took us 20 minutes. So there was a lot of things that happened during those 20 minutes. And at some stage, I'm like,
we'll do a montage for the movie. We're not going to show the whole 20 minutes of you swimming out there.
I'm actually saying things like, this is actually really beautiful. Like, this is incredibly beautiful. And Olivia's like, shut the fuck.
These will be good scenes.
Yeah.
These will all be good scenes.
Olivia,
in fact, maybe we will show all 20 minutes. That'll be its own thing.
Olivia was like, shut up, Jared. That's the edited version.
Yeah.
And understandably so I... shut up. But once we were on the boat, I was just laughing. Like, I think I was just delirious.
Delirious, hysterical, relief, laughing.
Yeah, like laughing, then crying. Then we opened up as the boat's going. Actually, I think it's because we had to stop several times just to listen out for other boats to see if we were being followed. And one of the times when we stopped, we opened up the bucket with all Olivia's $12,000 worth of what she puts food on the table with, and everything's dry. Her camera stuff's dry. Everything's fine.
Miracle number two, Jared. Miracle number two.
Which also meant we were going to get the footage out, because that was the other thing. We were like,
well, you've gone there to tell this story, and if you couldn't take the story out, then a lot of it feels not as worth it.
Well, even though we got the footage back and everything, and, you know, as we're talking about, I did this interview with Al Jazeera World News, and New York Times did an interview, but local stuff didn't want... They weren't interested.
So we spoke about this, like, really mostly off air, but let's talk about that, because I actually think that's interesting in itself. Mm. Just as a side note, let's not linger on it.
But yeah. And I was just going to say about that, Will, that, like, the sense of failure is already there, because there's so much responsibility. Like, these guys' stories are so precious, and I feel so powerless. I live daily with people who were on Manus. Like, this isn't abstract for me. At First Home Project, I live daily with refugees, and the sense of, like, I want to do my best to see that they have freedom. And, you know, have I failed? Like, did we go on the wrong day? Should the press release be written? Like, so that was all the stuff that, like, was going on for me yesterday.
Isn't it horrible that so much of it then still comes down to that? Because this, regardless of how you feel about this issue, this is actually just a really genuine boys' own adventure, fantastic story. Like, I mean, I know that it is so much more than that, and I don't want to belittle it in any way by saying that, but I just mean from the idea of being able to sell something to the media to get people interested in it. Like, there's...
And a story where you actually see what these men are like. Right. Their incredible kindness and courage, despite the whole thing, to actually see them and to have Australians there, like... You know, incarnational ministry, undercover journalism, like embedded journalism with the whole experience. And then to hit it on a news day where people are like, the ashes are on.
I mean, the ashes
are on. Yeah, it's important. Yeah, yeah, it is important. But
like, I did actually remember when I scheduled this for 5 o'clock that there was still an hour to go in that last session of the ashes, and thought,
phew. Will, suffering for Jesus. Yeah, thanks, brother.
Don't spread it around, mate. Don't let him start getting a big head thinking he's got me. You know, he hasn't got me. I just like the parties he throws. So, what is the major thing that you would like to say about, you know, what you learned? What would you love people to be, you know, taking out of, you know, this experience?
Yeah.
Like, what, you know, I don't want to say what did you learn, because I think that's too trite.
Yeah.
I want to know just genuinely what you would like people to know about, you know, this.
I want people to know about Adam, who was a guy who took my hand, who is from Darfur, where there was the genocide, who left the horror of that. He's the same age as my son. And my son, during the time he's been in detention, has finished high school. He's in his third year of uni. He's met someone special. He's had a job and saved up to go overseas with his mates, going to Japan in next month. And meanwhile, this young guy, he's grown up daily wondering when he'll see any sense of a life that isn't a prison. And his kindness to me, his courage in that situation, the fact that his mental health has survived, I want them to know about him. I want them to know about Ali, who rescued Olivia when the Navy were coming, who has a scar on the back of his head where the Taliban beat him with the back of an M16 rifle, where, because of his family's resistance to the Taliban's agenda, he had to find safety. And I want people to long for an Australia where we're worthy of these kind of people.
Jared McKenna speaking to Will Anderson after returning from Manus. Podcast Mike here. Up next, it's Julian Burnside, who was part of our 2018 series earlier this year. Julian is a barrister and a human rights advocate. He has spent a lot of his life doing pro bono work in support of human rights, and I think this portion of his chat really highlights his undying commitment to this cause. Enjoy.
Sit down and have a conversation with him about the world. My guest, this is how the podcast starts. Who are you?
Julian Burnside.
And Julian, what would you say is the major thing that you do right now? Tell people what you're up to at the moment.
Well, I'm a barrister, and so doing commercial litigation is what pays the rent, and doing human rights work unpaid is what makes practicing law seem useful.
Now, Julian, clearly, I've read online that you get $5,000 per visit to every...
Yeah, well, you know.
Are in this massive refugee racket. I've seen the blogs.
The blogs and the tweets. Yeah, that's right.
I've seen the tweets from cars.
It is fantastic what gets around with no factual foundation at all.
You've said it a million times, and you certainly don't need to say it on this podcast because this is not one of those sort of podcasts, you know. But there is no money in helping refugees, is there?
No. Well, and as a matter of principle, I don't accept any payment for any refugee work. I mean, I get invited to speak at all sorts of places about refugee issues, and I'm sometimes offered a payment. I always refuse it or say, look, you're rich, send a donation to the ASRC or something like that, because I figure it makes me too vulnerable to an attack on the footing that I don't actually mean what I'm saying if I get paid for it. I didn't realise it wouldn't stop the attacks.
Well, Julian, if you really cared, you know what you would do? You would actually have a refugee come and live in your house. How about that?
Well, we have done.
Yeah, I know.
Because... You see, Kate, my wife, is an artist, and when the Tampa thing happened, Kate was really offended by it, and she said, look, this is not what Australia is like. Most Australian houses have a spare room. We should set up spare rooms for refugees. That was her thinking. Artists think like that. And I said, well, look, if we're going to urge people to give refugees free accommodation at home, we have to lead by example. So since late 2001, we've had refugees living at home with us, free of charge, and it's been an interesting experience.
I want to talk more about that, and I'm sure we will, but I want to start with some other things first, if you don't mind. So what I ask people all the time on this podcast, it's the loose conceit of the podcast for a conversation, which is, do you have a particular philosophy towards something? It can actually be an actual philosophy, or it can be more a motto or a way of, you know, going about things. But is there one that you, a principle of some kind that you have?
I do have a philosophy. I don't think it fits into any particular school. One thing I'm not is I'm not a utilitarian. That's the one school of philosophy that I don't accept. I guess if I had to identify a philosophical precept, it is the golden rule, which is common to every philosophy except for utilitarianism, which is you do to other people as you'd have them do to you. And it's really interesting when you research it, you see that there's hardly a philosophy or a religion that does not have that expressed in some form or another. And it's a pretty good idea.
Yeah, because it is a pretty good idea. Letting the press, the power of, you know, people seeing these images and not seeing these images. The difference in that. I mean, obviously, you know, I would suspect, the cynic in me would always say that if the government have nothing to hide in these things, then, you know,
Why hide it?
Yes. That's always, you know, if they're hiding it and they're fighting so hard to hide it,
yep,
then what are they hiding? Now, is part of what they've done so effectively kept the world's media from seeing pictures, kept the media from being in there so that Australians can actually see it for themselves?
I think that's been an important part of it, because I think if most Australians saw what's going on, they would not approve. But then, who knows, you may get some brazen politician. I mean, remember when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister? There's a thought to comfort you.
I mean, yeah, it's hard to even comprehend that was true.
He received a report from the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, who reported that in relation to 5 cases that had been referred to him from Manus Island, Australia was in breach of its obligations under the Convention Against Torture, because the conditions in which they're being held constitute a breach of the Convention Against Torture. Tony Abbott's public response was, Australians are sick and tired of being lectured to by the UN. Mm. I mean, it's breathtaking.
Yeah.
That is so brazen. It is just amazing.
I mean, I was also sick and tired of being lectured to by the UN. And I was hoping our solution of that would be to stop doing things that we'd been lectured about. I was like, we can clear this up.
Yes.
Let's stop torturing people.
Yeah, good idea.
They might give us a pat on the back.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing.
While we're lobbying to be on all their councils at the same time.
I don't know if you remember, but in, was it February 2014, a bloke called Reza Barati was killed on Manus. And Scott Morrison, who I think is probably the second worst politician we've ever had, went public. He was the immigration minister at the time, and he said that Reza Barati had escaped from the detention centre and had been killed by locals, which is actually gives you a very interesting insight to what he understood about the attitude of the locals to refugees. A week or two later, I received some signed, handwritten eyewitness statements, including one from a bloke called Benham Sattar. Benham Sattar was the roommate of Reza Barati. And he said, no, what happened? Reza Barati was inside the camp. He was running across the compound trying to get to our room. And he was approached by a guy, one of the people on the Australian payroll, holding a long stick with nails sticking out of the end, at the far end of the stick. And he swung it at Reza Barati several times, hitting him on the head with it, lacerating his scalp terribly until he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely. He was then surrounded by 12 or 13 guards, people on the Australian payroll, who took it in turns to kick him in the head and in the torso, and until another guy came along, another person on the Australian payroll, with a big rock, brought it crashing down on Reza Barati's head. And Sattar's statement says, and that killed him. And I know it killed him because the next time one of the guards kicked him, he didn't flinch. Now, Benham Sattar, for his trouble, was dragged into the security cabin and tied to a chair and beaten up. And he was told that if he didn't withdraw his eyewitness statement, he would be taken outside the camp where he'd be publicly raped by locals. Now, that's what Australia is doing to people. And, of course, it was another 2 years before there was a trial. It was a plain case of murder. Benham Sattar's statement had identified by name the people who were centrally involved. And, strangely enough, the two people who were charged have managed to escape. And they've left the Australians who were part of the guard group that attacked Reza Barati, they were allowed to get back to Australia, so they're beyond the reach of the PNG authorities. And the PNG locals who actually killed him and were charged and convicted of murder 2 years later somehow escaped. Benham Sattar is still in Manus.
How do you keep fighting? How do you not want to sometimes just... Like, I mean, I understand, of course, like once you've seen, you can't unsee.
Hmm.
But you've seen so much now. And there must be a point where you just must think, not that you want to give up the fight, but that you just long for the fight to be over.
Oh, I do. I long for the fight to be over. But I guess I'm just persistent.
Right.
And if Peter Dutton ever happened to listen to this, I'm not fucking giving up.
I don't think Peter Dutton's going to listen, but you know, probably somebody from the Herald Sun will listen and they'll take choice quotes out of it.
Oh, Andrew Bolt will write another blog.
Yeah, exactly. You'll get a Bolt blog out of it. How have you dealt with that aspect of what it is that you do? The you have become, for a people like an Andrew Bolt, who likes to write the same blog post every 4 days, and so it'll be like Julian Burnside and refugees, and then the next day it'll be the ABC, and then it'll be the Green something, and then like it's all cut and paste down at Bolt Corp. But when you become this prominent advocate, and people want to pursue an agenda that they don't want to hear the things that you're saying. It doesn't fit the narrative they're trying to put out publicly. Then what comes with that is a lot of playing the man. Mm. Like what comes with that is a lot of people not wanting to answer your arguments or not wanting to, have a debate about what it is that you're saying, the facts of the case. They'd rather the best tactic is to devalue the idea that your opinion is legitimate in the first place. Mm. I imagine that must be difficult.
It is. It is. But I don't plan to give up. And I can't remember who said it, but someone like Nelson Mandela or someone like that said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they attack you, then you win. So I didn't know the attack phase would last so long.
Right. tell me, give me some hope. Give me something that that maybe people who are listening to this, let's assume that Peter Dutton hasn't whacked it on his iPod, and let's assume that Scott Morrison isn't going through a contemplative period of his life where he regrets the decisions he made and realized that once in his political career he had all this power and he could have actually used it for something good instead of he made Australia, the country that he purported to love, a nastier and meaner place, and then Dutton tagged in like the real villain that Scott Morrison prepared the way for, because that's what Morrison's got to remember.
Yeah,
reckon he probably is a slightly more decent human being than Peter Dutton, but he made the space, the decent human being made
except
the space.
Except this. I've read Morrison's maiden speech in Parliament, and he makes a great deal of the fact that he's a very religious person. He actually quoted portions from the Bible about his philosophy, and yet he behaved, as a parliamentarian, he behaved in ways that were irreconcilable with those views. Now, that strikes me as being evidence of a very deeply flawed person. Now, I mean, Dutton's flaws are obvious. Morrison's flaws come not just in his behaviour, but the disconformity between his behaviour and his apparently sincere beliefs.
It is the ultimate thing about this issue that I think is that, what was the reason that you wanted to get into power? Was it power for power's sake? If so, I understand perhaps some of this. This is about hanging on to power, and you know, you don't care who gets hurt along the way as long as you can hang on to your power. If that's the explanation, then I guess it makes some sense. But in any other way, if we are to believe the thing that we are told about politicians, that most of them get into it for good enough reasons, they believe in some cause or something or whatever, I don't think anyone's cause was, I want to persecute children, that I want to torture innocent people who are just fleeing a horrible life to get to somewhere better. You can't start out with that. I hope you can't. Anyway, let's not talk about them. Let's talk about what people who actually care about this can do. What would be a more practical solution? What would be, in your, like, you know, opinion, and you know, just your opinion, but in your opinion, what would be, if you could tomorrow change what we're doing, and they decide to come to you and they go, you know what, let's assume that Dutton and Morrison both listen to this podcast and they're both turned around by the compelling arguments that have been put forward.
Yeah, okay.
And they come to you and they say, we need an alternate policy. What is it?
Yep. Okay, well, as an alternate policy, first of all, I would shut down offshore processing for good and all, okay? And I would, you know, if you have to sell it to the public, you sell it on the basis, well, we've been lying to you, they're not criminals, they're not dangerous, we don't need to protect ourselves from them, and it's costing us a fortune. So we're closing it down. Second, I would say that our annual refugee intake should be increased quite significantly. At the moment, it's a pretty modest, and we could take more because we're a big country. Third, I would say that if people come here seeking protection who haven't had prior permission, then I would say first rule is you treat them decently. By that I mean you don't lock them up, you don't treat them badly. There may be a few instances where, because you've got concerns about their security position, maybe they need to be held in detention for a bit while you check it out. But you don't mistreat them, because we are supposed to be a decent country. That's the principle. And would that be a problem demographically? Well, the numbers have never been all that great. The numbers coming by boat have never been that great. We probably had more. Well, 1788 was a big time for boat arrivals.
Yeah. the Indigenous Australians might have liked a policy that was more about them deciding who came here and what circumstances
I actually saw a great cartoon once, and it's obviously January 1788, and it's a black fella looking down at the First Fleet in Sydney Cove, and he's got a can of British paints in one hand, and on an adjacent surface he's scrawled, "Stop the boats."
Yeah.
Anyway, but we I mean, it's an old trope, but we've got more non-Australians in the community who've overstayed their visas, who've come as backpackers from Canada, America, England, and so on. More of them than we've ever had boat people coming seeking protection. But if people are seeking protection, then I think we owe them an obligation to treat them decently. With my last breath, before the lights go out, I'd prefer to say I'm glad I tried, rather than I wish I'd done something.
Guys, that's it. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed any of these chats, head to tofop.com to hear them in full and the entire backlog of episodes. We're putting these compilation episodes out on Tuesdays and Thursdays for the coming weeks. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and tell a friend if you like them and recommend an episode to them if you can. We've also got an Instagram and Twitter page, WilosophyPod. That's P-O-D. You can also go to patreon.com/tofop to pledge any support and donate to the show as well, which helps keep the show running. Other than that, thank you very, very much for listening.